Good evening and welcome to the LSE and welcome to the new academic year, because today is the first day of the academic year, so it's an important day in the life of the LSE. I'm Francesco Caselli, I'm a professor in the economics department, and I have the pleasure to welcome you and our speaker, Ryan Avent. Ryan is a senior editor at The Economist, and more importantly, is an LSE graduate. He has an MSc from the LSE, so it's a bit of like a homecoming for him, and we're very, very happy to welcome him back. The topic of tonight's presentation is Ryan's new book, which is about how technology is changing the labor market and what labor all means and what working will all mean, given the changes in technology. So no more introduction, Ryan.
Well, thank you all so much. This is just a fantastic crowd. Congratulations on the start of the term. I hope it all goes well for you. It's been a very long time since I was a student here, and I was surprised to walk down the street and find buildings missing since the last time I was here. But it's wonderful that the LSE is growing the way that it is. There we go. So I'd like to start off the talk tonight by reflecting on the Luddite fallacy, which is something you take economics classes here, you might have some exposure to. And I think it would be good to reflect on it and on the lessons that we've drawn from it. The Luddites, as I'm sure many of you know, were groups of English textile workers who were working in the early 19th century, who were producing craft textiles largely out of their cottages, and who were confronted by economic change in the form of these new technologies, things like spinning frames and powered looms, which threatened their ability to survive. The new machines came in and could use less skilled labor to produce much more, and which threatened the old cottage industry and made it uneconomical. And so the reaction was basically to run riot, to pick up sledgehammers and to attack machines and factory owners and to try to disrupt this process. And we don't think too highly of this today. We tend to use Luddite as a term of ridicule, and we consider them essentially absurd people. And that's for a few reasons. One is that they're seen as resisting kind of the irresistible force of technological progress. Another is that this irresistible force of technological progress has, over the last two centuries, made us all much richer, allowed us to live longer, happier, healthier, fuller lives. And so it was seen as, you know, an absurd for them to want to impede this progress. But there's a third thing that adds to the sense of absurdity about the Luddites, which is that we often see people arguing that it was, in fact, against their own self-interest to do this. That if you think about what technology does to the workforce, it does eliminate jobs, but it inevitably creates new ones and creates oftentimes better jobs, and that, in fact, they were shooting themselves in the foot by smashing these machines. And I think this is a little unfair to the Luddites. I think, first of all, we should have a little more sympathy to them, in part because they didn't have the hindsight that we have. But also, I think if you look back at the history of the Industrial Revolution, you see that, in fact, it was a much more difficult, fraught, and contingent process than many of us like to imagine. That for the first century or so, after steam engines began to come into use, living standards for many industrial workers barely rose at all. To earn these industrial wages, they had to go live in cities, which killed them almost as quickly as they could arrive from the countryside, things like cholera and crime. And then even after things began to get better for workers, it remained the case that many of the gains from growth flowed to the owners of factories and the owners of land and things of that nature. And really, it wasn't until much, much later on, in fact, the middle of the 20th century, that we created an industrial economy that really seemed to work for the great bulk of workers. And so if you were a Luddite or a potential Luddite in 1815 or so, contemplating this future, and someone were to tell you, well, you know, your great-great-grandchild will probably have a fantastic life working a 40-hour week and a union-protected job and be able to afford an automobile, but things are basically going to suck for you for the rest of your working life. It's not at all clear to me that they would have said, well, you know, that's a bargain I'm going to accept and to put down the sledgehammer. And I think we need to keep that in mind as we think about the digital revolution. Now, the impetus for the book is to try to explain many of the difficulties that we have seen in the global economy that have arisen over the last two or three decades. And there are a number of troubling trends that we notice in the data. Productivity growth, which had been rapid in the decades after the Second World War, slumped in the 70s, picked up again in some countries in the 1990s, but then slumped again. It's been particularly bad in recent years. At the same time, wage growth has been disappointing across rich economies, especially since 2000. And work really hasn't been very rewarding at all. The share of income flowing to people from wages has been declining as a share of total income. And the share going to owners of capital or to land has been rising. And in fact, in some countries, that overstates how well workers are doing, because within the workforce, inequality has expanded. And especially in Anglo economies, the top 1% have been doing much, much better than the rest. And these trends have knock-on effects across social institutions. They lead to a sense of isolation in the communities that are left behind. They have effects on people's well-being. If you look at some countries, you see rise in suicides and in rates of drug addiction, especially in the U.S. And they create a sense of anger and potentially resistance to change that can be tapped by politicians. And increasingly, we are finding politicians on the radical fringe of existing parties or new parties that are happy to turn this anger and disgust with the way the world has turned out into support for nativist policies, for racism, and for rejection of the institutions of globalization that, in fact, have made much of us much better off over the last generation. Now, my book tries to explain all these trends in one neat little package, and that's a big undertaking, I realize. But I think that there is a common force at work, and I blame the robots, essentially. I blame the digital revolution. I think that that in fact what ails us is not that there is too little economic change and transformation underway, but too much for us to handle. And within the world of economics, there is a lot of disagreement on this point. There are those, like Robert Gordon at Northwestern University, who look around and see technology and say that it's just not nearly as powerful and transformative as the kinds of things that happened during the Industrial Revolution, as electricity, as the development of the automobile and airplanes, things that fundamentally transformed society from the pre-industrial age to, say, the 1950s, that things like social networks and 3D printers just aren't that impressive. And on the other hand, you have people, a good example are Eric Bjornson and Andrew McAfee, who've written books such as Race Against the Machine and Second Machine Age, who argue that actually the digital revolution is potentially massively transformative, that in particular the use of big data to power machine intelligence is going to allow us to do many things that only a few years ago we wouldn't have thought possible. And we see that in the arrival of things like driverless cars, which in the middle of the 2000s seemed like distant sci-fi future and which now are being tested on city streets around the world. Now, whenever these two sides argue, inevitably the argument comes back to the data, and the skeptics have a powerful point on their side, which is that the productivity numbers and the income numbers strongly suggest that we're not undergoing a transformative, powerful economic revolution. And so any story that tries to argue that actually technology is the culprit here has to explain that. And I think I can do that. Now, the book is called The Wealth of Humans, and I think the kind of key forces, the key ways in which the digital revolution is affecting the economy boil down to different conceptions of this wealth of humans. And one is a simple abundance of labor, that if you look at the way digital technologies are being used around the world, they are massively increasing the amount of effective labor that's available to firms. And they're doing this in a few ways. One is actually through automation. We've seen over the last two or three decades or so, a process of hollowing out or polarization, where routine tasks on factory floors or in offices have been replaced by robots and by clever software. And this has, as it displaces workers, it pushes more people into this pool of willing workers looking for jobs. At the same time, it has made some highly skilled individuals much more productive and able to do the work that previously took many more people to do. So you have highly compensated lawyers doing serving many more clients than they previously could. You have small hedge funds running money that couldn't possibly have run in the past, thanks to digital technologies. And so that increases the amount of effective labor available to firms. And then the third key force at work is globalization. And what we have seen over the past two decades is an era that's occasionally called an era of hyper-globalization, is the spread of supply chains around the world in a way that has allowed global trade to grow at twice the rate of global GDP. And this would not have been possible without the digital technologies that allow an Apple, for instance, to track in a high level of detail what's going on in factories around the world. And the upshot of this hyper-globalization has been the bringing into the global labor force of hundreds of millions of low-wage workers in places like India and China. And the net effect is a reservoir of workers seeking jobs, a glut of labor, a wealth of humans, if you will. And this is something that the economy has struggled to deal with. And it's struggled for a few reasons. The main one, I think, is that we lack the adjustment mechanisms that we had available to us in the 19th and 20th centuries. Then, for instance, you could take workers off the farm and you could teach them to read, to do basic arithmetic, and suddenly they were able to be much more productive and take some of the new jobs being created by technology. You could take them off the farm and move them to cities that were growing at an enormous clip, and in that way match them with new technologies that could put their skills to good use. And in this way, we were able to facilitate an adjustment by making workers more productive. Many of those adjustment mechanisms are no longer available to us. Most workers, in the rich world especially, are extremely highly educated. The rate of completion of bachelor's degrees across most of the rich world is about 40%. And completion of secondary school is about 90%. And it's really, really difficult. It's not impossible, but very difficult to raise that even further. And at the same time, there's pressure to add jobs in highly productive cities, of which London is one. And yet it's difficult to ask someone to pick up and move, especially when their rent is going to quadruple in the process, or quintuple, or whatever it is these days. It's quite significant in London. So because these adjustment mechanisms aren't available to us, and because workers aren't allowed by the welfare state to simply drop out, because that basically forces them to live in poverty, workers have no choice but to accept whatever wage is available to them to do jobs, to retain work, to pay to put food on the table and a roof over their heads. And so what we've found is that wages have been stagnant as the economy has worked to digest this abundance of labor. And then ironically, firms have found it advantageous to use workers in low productivity tasks. So if you're Amazon and you have a warehouse, you could invest in robots to manage the logistics tasks in that warehouse. Or if you have an ocean of cheap labor available to you, you could use those workers instead and not make that investment and not improve productivity. If you have a shop, you could invest in technology to automate the tills. Or if you have a long queue of workers willing to work for nothing, you could employ them instead. And so The kind of ironic outcome of this process of rapid technological change is that we're employing a lot of people to do low-wage tasks at very low productivities. And that is the main way in which I square these two stories of skepticism and optimism about technology's role. Now, that is not the only major force at work here, or the only way in which the digital revolution is affecting what's going on in the global economy. Conveniently, the other force can also be summarized in the phrase, the wealth of humans, and that is what I call social capital. Now, social capital is not an original idea to me. It's been used by a lot of people to mean a lot of different things, from trust to the amount of friends you have in your Facebook network. But I use it in a very particular way, and that is to represent what I call context-dependent patterns of behavior or context-dependent culture. It's basically the way we all know how to behave within particular settings. And this is perhaps easiest to see within the firm. Within firms, as you all will learn someday, there are things that new hires quickly learn about how the office works. What's the appropriate way to raise a complaint with your boss? What's the right time to present a new idea? Or how much autonomy you have in trying to streamline a particular process? These are all things that typically aren't written down. They're absorbed over time. they amount to a firm culture, and that culture differs dramatically from firm to firm. Now, what's interesting, I think, is that this culture has taken on a huge economic importance over the last generation or so. It's always been important. It's always been something that mattered. 150 years ago, if you were in a factory, you needed to know which guy was able to kick the machine to make it work when it stopped working. And that was part of the culture of the time. But this factor has taken on a much more important role over the last 30 years. And one way to see this is by looking at the book value of S&P 500 corporations versus their market capitalization. And back in the 1970s, if you broke down the value of a company, about 80% of it was tangible stuff. It was buildings, it was machines, it was payroll, it was intellectual property, things that you could put a value on. And only about 20% of it was dark matter, was intangible. That ratio has since reversed. In fact, only about 20% of stuff is stuff we can look at and touch and measure. And 80% of it is unexplained. And not all of that is social capital, but I think quite a lot of it is. And the way to understand that is to think about how the global economy has changed over that time. If you're Apple, you're a manufacturer. You're making physical goods that people can pick off shelves and buy. But none of that value that you're creating depends on your physical ownership of machinery or even of a particular building. What it comes down to is the way the firm processes information, the way it gathers information about what is possible, what can be designed and engineered, how it can be marketed, what people might want, and then ultimately how the massive supply chain that's required to make these things can be managed. It's all about the processing of information. And culture within firms, these patterns of behavior, are like the software code within a computer. They govern the flow of information. And the companies that are most successful are the ones that have incredibly good, valuable social capital. Now, social capital isn't only relevant within the firm. It's also relevant within cities. It's one of the things that makes cities like London so valuable, and that is in part because cities with valuable social capital choose to locate here. It's also because there is a particular culture to places like London or to Silicon Valley or to New York that makes businesses that choose to locate there more successful. And it's also true of countries. There are patterns of behavior within rich economies that poor economies find it difficult to emulate, and which inhibit investment and learning and the startup of new businesses and growth. Now, if you combine these two forces, you end up with a very pernicious dynamic, I think. The abundance of labor means that worker bargaining power is limited, and social capital reinforces this limitation in important ways. If you are a worker in a successful firm, and in my book, I use The Economist as an example. It's not the case that your human capital doesn't matter. It does matter. Your ability to report and write and have knowledge and expertise that is transferable to other settings, that all matters. But it doesn't matter as much as social capital. It doesn't matter as much to your success as your ability to navigate that organizational culture. And so what that means is when it comes time for you to go to your boss and command a greater share of the profits generated by the firm, you have less bargaining power. You can say, I'm going to threaten to take away my human capital and go to a rival. But what you can't take with you is the social capital, because that doesn't work elsewhere. It doesn't translate. And so that allows the firm to say, you know what, we can hire someone else. They're going to be about as good as you, and they'll be highly motivated to learn the social capital within our organization. And so that fundamentally changes the way that bargaining power within the firm works, within the economy works. And it also changes the way we think about others across the economy and across the world. Because the key to getting rich is to be located within one of these wealthy communities with valuable social capital. The way to make a worker rich is to move them from a place that lacks this kind of social capital to a place that's rich in it, to allow them to migrate from a poor country to a rich country. The way to make a worker, be they an electrician or a lawyer or a computer scientist, better paid and better off, is to move them from a city that lacks valuable social capital to one that's rich in it, to move them from a small town to London, for example. And the way to make a particular worker in one company richer is to allow them to work within a firm that's highly productive. But that means that we have to pay quite a lot of attention to who belongs in these firms. And if you are within one of these valuable communities, you suddenly have a very strong incentive to pay close attention to who is brought within it and to what they bring and to the way in which that affects your share of the pie. And that brings us to, I think, the way in which these economic trends interact with the social and political trends that we now face. That fundamentally, the digital revolution is forcing us to reconsider how we are going to share the wealth generated by humans in different contexts. And we're not doing a very good job answering that question. That's pretty gloomy. So let's talk about potential solutions. There are some. I think in the short run especially, there are quite a lot. And one is to try to do what we did in the 19th century and work to make technology more complementary to the skills that workers have and to make workers a better fit for the technologies that we're creating. There are a lot of ways to do that. There are certainly investments that could be made in places with valuable social capital, like London, to allow more workers in, to build more housing, to build the transport that would support more housing. There are certainly low-hanging fruit to be had, investments in things like early childhood education or university degrees or other things that could help prepare workers for the kinds of opportunities that are being created within these new sectors and these new firms. But there are several reasons to be skeptical about the potential to fall back on that old solution. One is the fact, as I mentioned before, that there's just not as much room. There's not as much low-hanging fruit as there was in the 19th century. It's quite a big lift. Another is that as we make workers more productive, it contributes to this abundance. As we make workers more effective at doing their jobs, as we allow them to be more productive, that adds to the pool of effective labor. And so that and it makes their lot in life better, but worsens the broader problem. And I think we see this a bit when we look at patterns, when we look at some of the data for higher education, that the premium on graduate degrees that you get from completing a graduate degree relative to a bachelor's degree keeps on growing. But that's a level of education to which most people can't expect to rise. The premium on a college degree is flat. It's not shrinking. It's flat. Still a good thing to do. But increasingly what we're seeing in both Europe and America is downward educational mobility, downward skills mobility, where people who complete college degrees are taking jobs for which they're overqualified, displacing less skilled workers down still further. And that suggests to me that we are simply running into the limits of our ability to solve this problem simply by relying on education and investments in training and things of that nature. That brings us to the second solution, and this inevitably will be a huge part of the way that humanity responds to these challenges, and that's to redistribute wealth. Now, there are quite a lot of ways in which this could be done. It could be done through increases in the minimum wage, could be done through the adoption of something like a universal basic income, in which there's a great deal of interest. It could be done by adopting common share ownership, by saying if, in fact, the robots are going to generate all this massive wealth, then the solution is to give everyone a share of ownership in this robot society and let them earn the dividends themselves. I think the problem that we run into here, there are two problems, actually. One of them is that it exacerbates the conflict between insiders and outsiders, that whatever your chosen solution, whatever your chosen form of redistribution, eventually you have to ask the question, who belongs and why are they entitled to this share of the wealth that humanity is producing? And so if you think about a universal basic income, it's a lovely thing in that it solves the purchasing power problem entirely. People don't have to work. It severs the connection between work and wages. And so we're free to kind of go about our business automating everything. And if workers are displaced, they're fine. They can go out and put food on the table. But those aren't the only roles that work plays in people's lives. It's not just about the purchasing power. It's also about providing people with a sense of meaning. And it's also about earning a social currency, earning the right to say, I've contributed to society and I'm therefore entitled to earn a piece of the social safety net. I'm entitled to social insurance and to the benefit of National Health Service and things of that nature. And so if you take that away, you need another means of deciding who is entitled. And it's possible that we come up with a solution that's similar to what Tony Atkinson has argued for, that there's a participant's income that people receive for volunteering their time or participating in community service. But it's also possible that the thing we decide is a qualification for receiving these benefits is looking like us, whoever us is. Could be that we want Scottish dollars for Scots, or that we want white dollars for whites, or that we want Christian dollars for Christians. The significant problem with this way of looking at the world is that it encourages people to draw the circle of affinity closer around them and distribute that wealth only within this group of people that looks like them. So that's quite nasty. The other problem is, which is equally significant, is that it requires political leverage. It requires a political movement to achieve. This was the slide for the last point that I made, which you can observe. It requires a political solution. Now, in the 19th century, when we think back to how the social safety net evolved, how institutions evolved, to get to the point where the Luddites were no longer facing their demise, but were instead at a point where people were entitled to cradle-to-grave social safety net, quite a lot of political change had to happen. You had the rise of trade unionism. You had the development of labor-oriented parties. And then eventually, you had the post-war labor majority government in the U.S., and you had similarly minded governments across the rich world that led to the creation of this welfare state. But this didn't happen because suddenly people became enlightened and decided that this was a good thing to do. It happened because workers were able to wield leverage, because they were able to organize and demand change. And building the institutions that allowed them to do that, and the leadership to encourage them to do that, and the ideology that would underpin their movement to do that, took decades. And we're only beginning this process now, and we have a long way to go. It wasn't simply the fact that we had this political evolution that had to take place. There was another component of the development of social safety net, and that was changing ideas about what is good and right in society, about what is fair, and about what people are owed. And there was a parallel movement of social reform that happened alongside the growth of trade unionism that affected our views on slavery in the United States, that affected our views on discrimination, on colonialism, on geopolitics. There was a further chapter of the Enlightenment that shaped the way we thought about other humans. And I suppose that the right way to think about the challenges that we face is to think that we need both of these things to happen over the next few decades, potentially over the next 50 to 100 years. We need, on the one hand, to think of ways or to encourage ways, mechanisms through which people who are not benefiting from the current economic arrangement can demand more. And we need to understand it's going to be a messy process, but that the alternative is potentially something much worse. And we also need to change the way we think about each other. And that seems like a super pie-in-the-sky kind of silly way of approaching things. But the book is called The Wealth of Humans, but in fact it closes with a reference to a theory of moral sentiments, which is another Adam Smith book, Wealth of Nations being the first. And in the theory of moral sentiments, Smith refers to human empathy as this great, powerful force that allows us to look out for each other and to provide for each other, and that is a motivation equally important to that self-interest that he describes in The Wealth of Nations. And I think what will ultimately be our salvation as a society, what will ultimately underpin the institutions that make the digital revolution work for us, is a change in the empathy that we have to others and a change in the definition of who we see as being like us. We will need to see everyone on this world as being like us. Perhaps the thing that will spur that will be the growth of, and this is very highly speculative, of a race of robots. Maybe that's the thing that will urge us to think of ourselves differently. But we need to begin on that process now, and we need to be aware of the risks that accompany any period of dramatic change and not take it for granted that things are going to work out okay. I think I'll conclude there and take questions.
Thank you very much, Ryan.
I do prefer. Your choice.
Okay, we have a microphone in the room, so just show your hand and gentleman up there.
Hi, I'm Ramin from the economics department at SOAS. I don't know, I don't want to sound too negative, and I don't know how to sugarcoat my question, but what is the new stuff in there?
Do you mean the new technologies?
No. The new ideas in the book.
That's a great question. Okay. So I like to think that the book is chock full of new and brilliant ideas, which can only be gleaned by reading it and buying it first. And I encourage everyone to do so. But I think if I were going to, what I would see as being the two big contributions are first the idea that the slowdown in wage growth and in productivity growth is actually a result of rapid technological progress. It's the failure of our institutions rather than our innovation that is causing all these troubles. And then the other thing I would say is the contribution, I hope, is the increasing importance of social capital and the way that affects insider-outsider discussions in politics.
Which reminds me, I had to tell you that you can buy the book outside, and after that you can come back here, after we're finished, of course, and come on this podium and get Ryan's signature. Gentleman with white shirt and green tie.
Thank you. You've Andrew Rickson. I'm a public health doctor. You've largely constrained your discussion to the developed world, and I'm thinking about some of the things you're saying about history, whether they may now be applying to the developing world, and that productivity increases. For instance, mobile phones networks in Africa may be where the productivity is happening, gains are happening now rather than here. And if that's the case, does that change what you've been describing?
I'm so glad you asked that. There's a chapter in the book devoted just to this question. I think we take it for granted, based on the experience of the last two decades, that emerging markets grow rapidly and catch up with the rich world. And the sort of striking thing when you take a step back is that before, say, the mid-1990s, it was assumed quite the opposite was the case, that poor countries almost never grew faster than rich countries and only rarely made the leap from poor country status to rich country status. And I think what happened over the last 15 years that changed that dynamic is this globalization that occurred because of the digital revolution. And supply chains actually allowed a shortcut around the bottleneck, which I think is a social capital bottleneck, that what Japan managed and what South Korea managed and Taiwan managed was to build institutions or take advantage of institutions that they'd previously failed to exploit, to develop the broad capacity to be a rich country. But that was a hard process, which most others couldn't imitate, and which took a long time. China and Vietnam and others who've experienced very rapid growth since around 2000 skipped a lot of that process because they were able to say, Apple, we will happily take a factory and assemble components that you bring to us. Now, the sort of downside to this model of development is that while it's very rapid and allows you to get richer much quicker, it's also very shallow. And so when the advantages of low labor costs cease to be big advantages, you find yourself in a difficult place. And I think actually that's the problem that the emerging world will face in the future. First of all, that in countries that have already begun this process, that the response to rising wages will be automation. That puts a cap on the level of development there. And secondly, that many other countries, including those that have enormous demographic growth expected over the next century, will not be able to find a footing on this ladder in the first place, because the digital revolution is such that low labor costs in places like sub-Saharan Africa simply are not much of an attraction because workers aren't necessary. And so they are stuck without a development model. So I'm pretty gloomy about that as well.
Yeah, this person on the second line with the orange T-shirt?
Like a salmon.
Referencing your talk about the need for social change and social reform to deliver more inclusive growth, I was wondering, do you see the role of government as kind of an overseer of a very flexible market, which they kind of largely, in terms of regulations, keep out of, but seek to kind of pad and smoothen out the kind of harshness of it? Or do you see a more interventionist role to do with kind of trade union regulations and things of that nature?
Well, I think there are trade-offs involved, and different countries will make different choices. I mean, I think there is a model in which you have relatively free and open markets, combined with quite a robust safety net. This is sort of the Scandinavian model. But that model, we'll find it draws a sharp division between insiders and outsiders. And so that will be one choice that people make. Another will be more of a corporatist model. And another will be sort of the American model, where we don't have much of a safety net, but we are traditionally, at least, somewhat more open to immigration. And I think these will, in terms of which is, my preference would be to combine, to sort of, if I could wave a magic wand, I would say the solution is to have a global model like the Scandinavian model, but that is absolutely politically impossible. And so the question becomes, what's politically realistic? And that depends on how this social negotiation that's only just beginning plays out within different countries.
On this issue of the insider-outsider, can I try a slightly more optimistic tack?
Please do.
So you start redistributing heavily, and then there is a question of where do you draw the line between those who receive and those who don't receive. Mm-hmm. But if it's true that we are on a path of being able to produce a bigger and bigger, massively bigger and bigger cake, thanks to technology change, might not it be the case that as we become incredibly productive as an economy and manage to produce an enormous amount of wealth, these issues of who's in, who's out become less important, and so they become naturally more generous because we are, there is more stuff to go around for everybody.
I think there is an endpoint, and there is a destination where technology has advanced to the point that the scarcity doesn't much matter.
Yeah.
And certainly that would be the logical outcome in that case. But in the short run, I think I'm not so sure. I mean, if I'm right, and I might not be, but if I am, that one of the ways we boost productivity is by finding ways to limit this abundance of labor, like sharing work or whatever, then we are necessarily going to be contributing more to people's purchasing power through redistribution or other mechanisms and asking them to do less. And I think the contract that's going to have to be struck between the people receiving more and the people giving more necessarily is going to have some terms about who's able to participate. I think it's interesting to look, for instance, at some Gulf countries. Gulf countries essentially have this magic, or they did at least until recently, this magic resource that freed them from scarcity. And they were able to redistribute fantastic amounts of money to people who didn't have to work very much or work very hard doing real jobs. And yet they chose to import quite a lot of labor and not to extend the full benefits of citizenship or even of human decency to many of those imported workers. And so I think lived experience suggests that in the short run, that trade-off does exist.
Michael Climes, I'm a journalist from a trade publication called Professional Pensions. With the increase in longevity and people living longer, it's become increasingly apparent that how are we going to pay for our retirement years? Will we be even able to retire? And with low returns and wages being low, how do you see what you're talking about affect people's ability to save for retirement, to have a pension or something along those lines?
Well, I think there's a couple dimensions to the answer. One is that, and part of the book, one chapter in the book goes into this, one is that I think the dynamic of secular stagnation, or the fact that we're kind of stuck in a world with a glut of savings and very low interest rates, has a lot to do with the way the digital revolution has played out, and in particular, inequality and the unequal distribution of resources. So solving that problem through better demand management or through more redistribution would, I think in my view, boost interest rates and perhaps growth rates, and that would mean you have a smaller hole to fill for many of these pension pots. But then I think, to the extent that the solution is going to be a political one in a lot of these countries that involves redistribution, you inevitably find your way back to questions about who belongs. And I think it's interesting to look at an economy like Japan, which has fantastic kind of fiscal difficulties and a rapidly aging population, and yet has not been particularly interested in importing lots of immigrant labor. They've opted instead to kind of do more automation, but the upshot of that has been stagnant wage growth. And so I think it's just you find your way back to these same trade-offs, whatever question you end up asking. And different countries will take different approaches to solving them, I think.
Back.
Hi there. You said that we couldn't increase productivity by educating more and increasing the levels of education in the country. But could it be that we're just educating the wrong things, and that an education fundamentally reoriented towards building and maintaining robots could make us a lot more productive and create a lot more high-skilled jobs?
Yeah. So I should make clear that I don't think I think there's room for improvement, quite a lot, in terms of our current policy choices. And we could be directing our energies toward much better ends. I think my view is that, or I know my view, is that machine intelligence is kind of a game changer, that as much as the book kind of looks back to the parallels with the Industrial Revolution, actually there's something fundamentally different this time around, and that's that machine intelligence is broadly applicable in lots of different places and is getting much better faster than we can retrain workers and reposition workers from one city to another. Basically, our capacity to adjust is not as great as our capacity to improve machine intelligence. And so I would say, by all means, we should think hard about whether we're training people in quite the right way. But I think over the next 2 to 3 decades, there's no real avoiding this crisis that's beginning to hit us.
Thank you, Ryan. My name is David Wood from London Futurists. Could you say a bit more about the optimistic scenarios that you've got in mind about how these hard political tasks might actually be progressed, either towards some kind of redistributive system or anything else? Do you think this notion of a wider ownership of everybody in the companies that will benefit from robots is a flyer? Or do you think that it's more likely we go towards universal basic income? So what do you have in mind?
In terms of, the potential for short-run improvements, I think there won't be the political consensus or agreement behind radical policies like a universal basic income. I think that's too big a step right away. So I imagine we rely more on a focus on full employment, either through demand-side policy or through things like a job guarantee, that we do much more wage subsidization, that countries demand much more provision of in-kind services. So in the U.S., we don't have free universal child care. I think that will be something that is put on the agenda. Bernie Sanders has asked for free higher education. That's something that will be put on the agenda. These will be ways that we redistribute wealth. But I'm optimistic about us coming up with solutions that kind of make the problem less acute. But to me, it seems they worsen the politics. And I guess I find it difficult over the short run to imagine a solution that solves both the political and the economic problem. I think if you were going to look for one, it would be that technology surprises us in its capacity to kind of create new political movements that are both kind of cross-country in nature and international in nature, and which are effective at demanding political change. But we see hints of that in kind of the reaction to kind of uprisings in various countries. But we're a long way away from a practical political force of, linked up millennials from around the world. I find it hard to be simultaneously optimistic about the economics and the politics. You're in charge.
Gentleman in the back there.
Hi, my name's Iffy. I'm from Ashmore Academy and I'm in year 11. I've recently been looking at lots of university courses that I could be able to do, and have been noting that there's been a massive increase in living accommodation prices as well as course prices as well. And it seems to be like, you know, with the new technological advances, there's less and less jobs for young people. And I know, like, in the news, this is becoming an increasing problem that student loans are getting a lot higher, but then there's less jobs for young people to actually take and be able to, you know, work off. And when people leave university, they're left with massive debts and then no jobs. So my question is, are there any solutions to this?
I think, certainly the financing of higher education is far from ideal, particularly in the U.S., but also in some other countries. I think it's a little difficult to prioritize free university, free higher education, because it's less progressive than it could be, because there's a lot of people who don't get the opportunity to go to university in the first place, and they pay into the general revenues. They're subsidizing people who are going to end up doing better than them. But that's an area for reform. I mean, I think when you're talking about the broader picture of employment prospects for people who are graduates, that's a more difficult question. And I think a lot of it comes back actually to the same thing that's affecting the cost of housing in places like London, that if that getting a good paid job in a city that has lots of new job opportunities is very difficult when rents are what they are. And the rents are what they are because we don't allow enough building. And that's sort of the uncomfortable truth of things. And we could probably get away with less building in central London if there are more transport options outside of London. I'm not saying there has to be Manhattan within the center city. But ultimately, if you kind of look at the way most careers progress, it's through the successful careers progress through a lot of job hops in places where there's a lot of other well-educated people. And these cities that offer these opportunities are incredibly expensive. And, you know, in the 19th century, cities like Manchester or Chicago grew 700, 800% in the space of a few decades, from specks on the map to cities with millions of people. And there's no reason to think that, you know, we should reasonably be doing something similar now, except that people just really don't like building in that way anymore. And so there are costs to that, and those costs are borne in large part by young people.
But having said that, the solution is not to get a college education, because the return to college compared to non-college have increased steadily over the last 30, 40 years. So if you think you get a college education and then you're going to have problems, that's nothing compared to not getting a college education.
Agree with that.
Hi, Angelo Martelli, PhD student here at the LSE. Actually, I would like to start from your first slide. I think that besides being empathetic with nowadays Luddites, therefore proposing the two solutions that you put forward, so on one hand, education. Actually, Larry Summers was sitting where you're sitting right now, and he said, you know, I think education can only be part of the answer, and from someone having been at the World Bank, it's a big thing to say, I think. And the second thing, the safety net. And I mean, you put forward the Swedish model as probably the best one, but actually upgrading is not going to be the best solution, I think, being also nowadays having routinization of high-skilled workers as well. So I think there is a third, in a way, solution that one can propose, and it was suggested by one of your colleagues in 1843 magazine, that is what Japan is currently doing with the Minister for Robots and trying to actually embrace technology as much as possible and actually having this immigration from the future, that's how he calls robots, be actually part of any industrial plan, any strategic plan for the future. I don't know how you see this.
It's an interesting point. And I mean, you can imagine a political movement that says, you know what, a world in which we don't have to work very much is an amazing one. We would like to be there now. Let's do everything we can to bring it about and to make sure that people aren't negatively affected by it. There's that, you know, that creates a very different set of policy priorities. I don't know that it eliminates the insider-outsider trade-off, But one complication with that is that if you want the buy-in of the labor force, you have to essentially convince them that it's okay to support social safety net policies that are designed to make them irrelevant as an economic force. So go to a trade union and say, what we'd like to do is make it so that trade unions never have any power in the future because they're not necessary. And that, I think, is from a long-run perspective, that might be the best way to generate a high level of prosperity for everyone. In the short run, it's politically a big ask. Japan is ahead of the rest of the rich world in a lot of respects, and it'll be an interesting test case over the next few decades.
Person in the third row up there.
Hi, Ryan. Thank you. Hi. I was wondering if at the start you mentioned that the returns from capital ownership and land ownership vastly outweigh the returns from work. Do you see that as technology advances that actually that will push the returns of that technology further into the owners of that capital, or will it actually liberate the many and producing increased returns from work?
You know what you want to do? I want to start taking two or three questions in bunches now because we are beginning to see the end. So I think the gentleman with the white shirt there, yeah.
Hi, a couple of things. My name's John. I'm a retired nurse. First of all, I want to find out how it is you got my picture when I was resting on the couch so happily there. I spent a very happy summer in Finland where I realized that there is a different way. People are not as constrained in their narrow-mindedness. They have several interesting things that they do. Every young man delights almost in doing his 6 months to a year of military service. So you chop out 4% of your working life straight away. They are trialing in two local authority areas a citizen's wage. They're currently working out what kind of ballot to pick the lucky winners with. They have very much better investment in tertiary education and in research, and it's paying off in their society. And it's almost as if we have given up and we've been conditioned by the sort of hyper-capitalism that we've been constrained by to the point where we've forgotten that there is actually at least the potential for a different way.
Let's get one more before. Here on the left. Here, extreme left. Here. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Aishna. I'm a general course student. First of all, we're all just big fans of The Economist. I guess. but I had a question more so. I guess small scale. So you kept on saying how social capital you think is the most important part of this new sort of digital world we're in. But as students who we were all raised in the American system, which is very old fashioned, and we're about to go out into the world, how do you suggest breaking into that world how do you suggest doing that, I guess?
Okay.
There's sort of a dynamic, I think, that's at work in terms of the return to capital and relative to the return to other things. And that is, the more productive a particular thing is, oftentimes the less able it is to capture a share of the wealth that it generates. So if you think about land in the 18th century, Ricardo worried that that landowners would eventually capture all the income that society generated because manufacturing was growing, the supply of land wasn't, and so the rents were just going to grow and grow and grow. As it turned out, we made farming much more productive, and the more productive food growth was, the less able farmers were to capture a share of the gains. So you could imagine a world in which, and I think this gets a bit to the kind of Star Trek point, which is that as machines become so productive that kind of the laws of scarcity begin to be repealed, they're no longer able to capture much of the gain from society. And the kind of the bargaining power flips. I think the the rub is that we're quite a long way away from that. Now, you could have, you know, one of the interesting things about this digital revolution is that even though it's so based in information technology and things like that, we're still all clumped together in cities. We're still all here in this theater. If technology advanced to the point where that was no longer necessary, then suddenly all the rents that accrue to landowners might vanish and go elsewhere, and that would be quite a big change. The problem is, it's really hard to imagine that happening, that even if, you know, you could do business in another with people in other countries, it's still people, I think, would want to be around. You know, people like being around other people. Like, you know, when they go on a date with someone, they want to be actually next to the person for a lot of reasons. So I think, you know, there are limits to that. Finland does suggest a different way. I think, you know, one of the things, if you were to go back to, say, 1850 and grab a random person and say, 100 years from now, taxation, top income tax rates in rich countries are going to be 90%. The state will provide childcare and free education and free health care and free pensions, and we'll just take up a third of GDP. People would say, well, that's insane. That's nuts. That would, you know, that's a totalitarian nightmare because it was so outside the realm of consideration. And yet, lo and behold, that's what happened. And so I think there is, to a large degree, solving the problem will require us to be a little more imaginative about what's possible. It just didn't happen overnight. And so I think that, you know, convincing Americans, for instance, that Bernie Sanders is right and that Denmark maybe has some things to teach America, that's not a process that's going to be to happen overnight. And part of it, I think, has to do with whether or not we all agree on the problem. And if until we agree on what precisely the problem is, it will be complicated to agree on a solution. How to break into the professional world of valuable social capital? That's a good question. I think it requires proximity. That's vague. It means being around people who in productive cities, working in productive companies, and trying to find ways to get your foot in the door. And having been in that position, like, it's just incredibly hard. And it's not a surprise that having personal connections continues to be something that's incredibly valuable. But technology does create the possibility of getting yourself on others' radar in a way that was not possible in the past. And in fact, you know, if I wanted to be an economist journalist, I would have had to either know an economist journalist, which is the way that really used to work, or go to Magdalen College at Oxford, which they would just back up a truck and load up a new generation of economist journalists, and that would be that. Or go through an incredibly competitive application process. And I would not have been able to do any of those things. I would never have had the job that I have now. But I started off as a blogger, writing my own blog, and that allowed me to get the attention of some people who thought maybe I would be a useful addition. They may have misjudged that, but it was thanks to that new technology. So I think finding ways, and the young people, I think, are often very creative at this, finding ways to make people in these worlds notice you through technology is a good thing.
Yeah, back there.
Hi, I'm Stephen Cooney, and I had a doctorate from this institution many decades ago. I would just say two things. First is that, I worked on a lot of these issues for the U.S. Congress in my last 10 years in Washington as an analyst and researcher on industrial issues. But the one thing I would, you mentioned Anthony Atkinson's book very briefly. And I think one of the major stumbling blocks to political change, and I think this is widely overlooked even by Atkinson in his own book, if you look at his charts and you looked at the breakdown of UK wealth by deciles, the top six deciles, yes, the number one decile shoots off that's the 1% or whatever they are. But the top six deciles also do much better than the cost of living increase. The next two or three deciles below that are around the average or maybe slightly below. It's only the lower tenth that are really hit in this country over the past 10 or 15 years by his data. And the consequence of that, and I think we would see something similar in the United States. I mean, we've seen similar data in the United States. And I would say the impact of that is that the lower 10% won't ever create a political change of the type you're talking about. It's not going to happen. They're too small, too weak. Go back to studies by Johann Galtung. They have least influence on society. The last comment I'd make is that Finland is a country of 5.5 million people, which is, and they're all Finns, and it's a smaller population than Greater Chicago. So I think, you know, that example works for Finland. It won't work in, say, America or Britain or other large multicultural societies. Thank you.
Down here.
I'm Canadian, so I'm going to have to use a Canadian example.
Okay.
In Canada, there's the First Nations or the Aboriginal people. The society is really decided because of historic wrongs during colonization that they would be supported, and in some cases by subsidy, in some cases by full support. And the country is certainly rich enough to do that, but it really hasn't done a particularly good job of creating healthy societies. And in Canada, First Nations are oftentimes at the top end of social ills. So I think we're all used to, we've all heard of the idea of the idle rich, but I don't think we've seen a lot of examples of idle middle class, and that seems to be very hard to do. And I don't know of places where this has worked out well. So I'm wondering why would you think we're all human ultimately? Why would you think it's possible to have idle middle class in a healthy way?
Let's pick up one last question and then up back there. And then we'll have to finish.
Hey, my name's Rob. So I'm wondering, what is the relationship between the digital revolution and climate change, and how will climate change impact on the wealth of humans?
Okay, good questions.
I'm not sure it's the lower 10%, I mean, so the farther down you go, the worse the performance. I mean, I think, you know, the latest census data that came out for the U.S. Showed that even though median income at the 50th percentile had jumped over the last year, it remained below where it was in 2007, which was itself below where it was in 1999. So I think it's not just the bottom 10%. But I think you're right that for political change to occur, there has to be the sense that lots of people, that a majority perhaps, are at risk of suffering from this revolution, and there also has to be—I mean, there has to be a sense of class consciousness, I think, in a sense that that the middle class that is at the 50th percentile in suffering is in more or less the same circumstances economically as the bottom 10%. And in the U.S., what you find is there's not that class consciousness. There's people draw a line. That line is typically drawn along regional or racial lines. And until you know, as long as that's there and that's the main dividing line, that's going to be the fault line along which policy is made, and that's kind of a bad thing. I agree with you about Finland. I mean, I don't think any of this will be easy. It's certainly much easier in a country like that than it would be in the United States. The ideal middle class. Well, I think it is the case that if you look at examples of subpopulations, and there are a fair number of them, that are provided for, and that could be people working in Gulf countries. It could be retirees on pensions. There are cases in which populations like the First Nations have been given basic income or something similar. Oftentimes, these things don't work out all that well. That there's a lot of boredom. That there's a lack of that happiness goes down and things like that. On the other hand, there have been some limited basic income experiments. There was one that was done in Minnesota. It's commonly cited that
shows quite the opposite, that actually health results and happiness results went up. I think it's really hard to know when you have just these isolated, I mean, it's a different world when you think this small community is going to get benefits and when you think the great mass of the population is going to get benefits like this. It requires an entirely different set of social infrastructure that we have to create. And but I think for better or worse, it is right to expect society to demand some sort of contribution in return, that will be the price. And it will be something that, that will involve volunteerism or community service or some sense of obligation to society. And I don't think we will allow there to be that kind of idleness. I could be wrong, but and then climate change, well, this goes different ways. I mean, I think technological progress in a lot of ways is allowing us to reduce the energy and carbon intensity of growth, not fast enough by any means. But there is a way to continue to enjoy economic growth, I think, and given the right policies, while also avoiding the most severe outcomes. The problem is a political one, and it's an especially pernicious one in the sense that the countries that are hardest hit are the ones who have generally done the least to contribute to warming. So it's poor countries who are less capable of responding, who are more vulnerable to things like sea level rise and droughts, and who have generally not been the ones pumping CO2 in the atmosphere at high rates over the last 150 years. And that's an equity problem. It's a problem that will generate a lot of migration pressure over the next 100 years. And I expect that to significantly exacerbate this insider-outsider dynamic, which is unfortunate. But the only way around that, I think, is a more enlightened kind of social philosophy that these people are owed something better. But I'm not super optimistic about that.
Well, that's someone you can always agree on. Okay, so before thanking Ryan again for his talk, let me remind you that Ryan will stick around up here for signing his book. And with that, thank you, Ryan, for a very good talk and very good talk.